The expression, the winners write the history books, may sound harsh, but there's something to it. The people who are considered the establishment or the mainstream in any society generally control the narratives about that society. And gay people in America still struggle to be considered part of society along with everyone else. Our guest this hour took a look back a few decades for his book, Stand By Me, The Forgotten History of Gay Liberation. Jim Downs teaches history at Connecticut College and is a history fellow at Harvard. His shorter work has appeared in Time, The Huffington Post, and The New York Times, among others. He's written three other books, including Sick from Freedom, about African Americans suffering from disease during and after the Civil War. Jim Downs, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
Which leads to questions about your last two books, this one and Sick from Freedom. Can you see similarities here, two groups that did not have confidence that their history would be told correctly?
Yes, I mean, there's definitely similarities because there are traditional narratives that we like to tell, as you mentioned, about Black people in this country and also about gay people. But as a historian, what's been so exciting for me is to go into the archives and find stories that challenge and undermine those often stereotypical portraits. So even though it might seem like my first book is very different from my second book, they're both in many ways thinking about moments of liberation, emancipation, and then gay liberation. And they're also thinking about the stories that we often tell about those periods and how they're often problematic and not entirely complete.
After a while, Jim, does history become oral history? Because it does seem like when you think about the way that people tell certain stories, and I can think about events in my own lifetime, that you look at the videotape and that did not happen the way people talk about it.
Right, right.
That sort of thing.
I mean, I think it begins as oral history. In fact, I mean, that was part of, in this project that was really exciting, is that there are still a lot of men and women who were part of the gay liberation movement in the 70s that are still around and they were willing to talk to me. And so their history, their stories, remain sort of untold. And that's what the point of the book was, to in some way tell that narrative.
So when you finally put your finger on what was lacking in the gay historical narrative, what was it?
Well, I think there's this story about gay people as hypersexual. And that's also a common trope in African-American history, especially among Black women, even Black men. And the idea was that gay people's hypersexuality was narrated in such a way in order to rationalize the spread of HIV. So in the 1980s, when the HIV virus broke out, journalists, doctors, public health officials, even gay people themselves had no idea what caused it. And so they looked at the 1970s, they turned back to this period, and they said that this moment of liberation gave way to this unfettered sexual world. And this unfettered sexual world was sort of out of control. And that's what led to the spread of HIV. And so what I was trying to do in the book was to say, can we think about the history of the 1970s without thinking about HIV coming? And look at the 1970s from the vantage point of the people who lived it. Look at the 1970s from the period of the people who sort of experienced it without knowing that then this narrative about HIV was going to develop.
Did you reach a conclusion about how widespread the hypersexuality was, or was that just what people noticed and actually not that many people took part in it?
Right. There's definitely that. There was a lot of people who didn't take part of it. And then there were a lot of people who took part of it, but also were involved in other parts of the creation of the gay community and gay culture. One of the things that I found that I thought was absolutely stunning in the archive was just the development of these gay churches that proliferated in the late 1960s, early 1970s. And so we have this sort of standard narrative that when gay people come out of the closet, they reject their families, they reject the church, they reject the institutions that have in many ways vilified them and pathologized them. But in actuality, gay people took refuge in churches. In California, Troy Perry established the first ever gay church called the Metropolitan Community Church, and it ended up having scores of chapters throughout the country. Gay men who were Catholics created a group called Dignity, and gay men who were Episcopalians created a group called Integrity. And so it's fascinating because, again, we have this sort of story, this narrative about hypersexuality or a party culture. And here, what I found was the thousands of gay men and women taking refuge in churches in the 1970s.
And there are some key vignettes in here. There's a great story that you tell about Father Robert Clement holding a service in New York City in 1970. And I guess, you know, given the way you dispersed information at the time, he gave out a lot of leaflets and things and just wasn't sure who'd show up, if anybody. So what did happen?
Right. So this was an interesting moment that he wanted to begin a gay church. He had heard about the churches that Troy Perry had established in California. He knew that in the 1940s there was a gay church in Atlanta, so he wanted to bring it to New York City. And so he was able to rent a church in Midtown in New York and hold the services. And this is, you know, before the internet, before social media. So the only way that he was able to distribute information about it was to have these flyers. And he hung the flyers up in bars. He walked into different communities and he gave them to people. And before the liturgy began, he just felt like no one's going to be there. He was just thinking like, no one is in the church yet. This is, you know, I can't believe this. I worked so hard to do this and it's not going to happen. And here, when when he arrived and walked down the aisle, the place was packed. So many gay men and women wanted to be part of this story.
One of many episodes told in the book Stand By Me, The Forgotten History of Gay Liberation. Jim Downs wrote it. He's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with him and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the historian Jim Downs from Connecticut College. We're talking about the history of gay civilization, as it were, in America, and the gaps he found in the history of that, basically jumping from the Stonewall riots of 1969 to the AIDS epidemic of the 80s, without a lot of pausing in the middle to think about ways in which people were living real lives and making great accomplishments. His book is called Stand By Me, The Forgotten History of Gay Liberation. You can join the discussion on the exchange by phone at 800-838-3760, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So we were just talking about this great moment where a minister says he's going to hold a service, a gay church service in New York, and people pack the church in ways he didn't expect. But that's the high point of your section on religion. It begins with a low point, though. When you talked about Metropolitan Community Church and its founding in L.A., it was a New Orleans branch in 1973 that had something horrible happen. Tell us about that situation.
So one of the things that happens is that when these churches begin to develop, they want to meet and rent churches and like traditional churches, traditional places. But many of those institutions refuse to allow gay people to congregate in those in their churches and in the major denominations. So what happens is gay people start to meet in people's homes. They use the bars. They use other community centers and places in order to have their liturgy. And in New Orleans, on June 24th, 1973, a bunch of gay men mostly sort of stack the bar in order to celebrate the fourth anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising, which is the official start of gay liberation. And they had a beer bus and they listened to Cher, and it was like this whole big party. And then around 7 o'clock, the beer bus ended, and members of the Metropolitan Community Church arrived in order to have their weekly liturgy. And they stood around a white baby grand piano where this guy across the street who played the piano at the Holiday Inn would lead them in song and prayer. There was a reverend there. And they're in this place. They're in the bar. And someone tries to get in. Someone or a couple of people try to get into the bar. And this is New Orleans. It's part of an area that was kind of becoming gentrified at the time. the way that it worked was that the building had bars across the window. They, in order to let people in, they had to make sure that they were safe and that whoever knocked on the door was in fact gay. And so they had a hatch, like a prohibition speakeasy, and they sort of like would open it and see who it is. And so somebody kept on knocking at the door, and they said, "Listen, we're fine. We have a liturgy going on." And then what happens is we don't know who returned, but someone came back and threw a firebomb on the second floor staircase leading up to the MCC church in the upstairs lounge. And what happened was the men in there were stuck. They were unable to sort of get out because there were bars over the window. Some of the thinner ones sort of miraculously squeezed their bodies through. Others tried to get out a back door, but the electricity went out. The smoke filled the room, and over 32 people were killed. In fact, Reverend Larson, who led the congregation in song and prayer earlier, was trying to get out of the break through a window. And when he broke through it, he conditioner out, and an air conditioner on the third floor, he was on the second, fell on him and killed him. And his body was then left for 24 hours, and it wasn't removed. And so there was a real sense of sort of homophobia in the way in which this massacre happened. It wasn't just the idea that all of these people were killed, but it was also the, you know, the question of how the police department and the fire department handled it, the ways in which the media sort of left sort of bigoted jokes, said bigoted jokes about it. They would say how many gay men died in the upstairs lounge, and they would say something like not enough. And so what I uncovered was that this is the largest massacre of gay people in U.S. history, and it remained completely absent from history books. And so I wanted to tell that story, and I wanted to tell about that community that built a church, and I wanted to tell about that community of people who died at the moment of liberation.
Jim Downs is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Stand By Me, The Forgotten History of Gay Liberation. How often in those media reports did anybody even mention the fact that this was a church meeting going on in this bar?
They didn't. I mean, and that goes back to the sort of earlier sort of comment that you mentioned in the opening segment, which is the fact that right away, the media and even locals only saw this as a sort of a site of recreation. They didn't know that this was also a congregation who met there.
You know, sometimes the media coverage can be shocking. I could just tell a little story of my own, which is going to back to look at the New York Daily News coverage of the Stonewall riots in 1969.
Right.
And the Daily News reporter is writing such and such, and the quotes from people and saying such a, he lisped, they would say, instead
right.
of just he said, which was shocking to me because my father lived in Greenwich Village from the time that I was 6 years old on. So, you know, I got
right.
to know the place pretty well, and it just seems strange that, anyway. So the history is told obviously different ways by different people. So zoom out a bit then from what happened at the Metropolitan Community Church fire in New Orleans. How common were crimes against gay people in those days?
They're very common. I feel like this is the other point that I really want to sort of make in the book, is that violence stalked gay liberation. And I think that we often have this sort of triumphant notion about gay people being liberated, gay people gaining rights in the early 1970s against employment discrimination, against anti-sodomy laws, all of these things. But in actuality, most gay men either knew of or were the subject of violence in the 1970s. And that is to say, these bars are often in locations where they're not necessarily protected by the police. They're often in locations that are, you know, challenging because of the sort of all the sort of mechanics of what it means to have a gay bar and where you could open it. The bars are often dark. The windows are closed. You can't see in them. I mean, it's interesting. If you could drive by a gay bar today, you can look inside and see it. You can see people inside it. In the 1970s, you couldn't. And that actually only contributed to violence because no one could see what was happening outside. And you go through the newspapers of the 1970s, and what I've done is read through tons of different newspapers in order to get my source material, and I couldn't get over the cases of violence, everything from the very famous case of the trash bag murderer, of a guy who would pick up gay men and then chop up their bodies and then put put them in trash bags, to just men and women being harassed on in and out of gay bars. So it's this untold story about liberation, and it's this untold story about how tenuous liberation was. I mean, today we have Supreme Court decisions about marriage. We have a representation of gay people on television. These are all major positive steps. In the 1970s, this didn't exist. I mean, gay people were still very much marginalized and the victims of many what we would call today hate crimes.
Was anybody ever caught for the fire in New Orleans?
No. There's talk among certain people who've studied it and who've read about it, and that there was one person who could potentially have been the culprit. But it seems to me that the evidence is really lacking. I mean, I was in New Orleans and I spent a week there reading through the police reports and the fire department reports, and they're just so contradictory. I mean, these gay guys would be starting out telling a story one way and then by the end finishing it a completely different way. And at first you're like, well, wait, are you lying? Like, why is your story changing over the course of a couple pages? And then you have to remember that in the 1970s, gay men were still using fake names in bars. Many of their families didn't know they were gay. So they may have moved to a place in New Orleans and from other parts of the South. And they didn't want to be recognized. They didn't want to be known. So part of this, sort of history is the stories of the ways in which so many gay men are still sort of living in the closet despite what seems to be a moment of openness and liberation.
Jim Downs, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Stand By Me, The Forgotten History of Gay Liberation, filling in some of the gaps between the Stonewall Uprising and the AIDS epidemic of the 80s. Join us on the Exchange with questions or comments, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Chris in Eugene, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jim Downs.
Hi. Will you comment on Hillary Clinton's statement after Nancy Reagan died, which then Hillary changed her statement?
But. Right.
All right. Thanks for that, Chris.
Right. So this is actually a really sad moment, and I've written about this in the Huffington Post and other places, that people don't need to learn and know gay history. And so one of the major hallmarks of gay history was that the Reagan administration refused to declare an HIV epidemic in the early 1980s. And for Hillary Clinton to then say that Nancy Reagan and Ronald Reagan actually began the conversation on HIV is really to like vitiate, this is the work of gay activists who actually began the conversation. And it's also the ways in which gay people's voices and experiences have been distorted. Reagan worked against sort of talking about HIV. And it was a ground, it was a ground swelling movement that began among gay men and lesbians to actually draw attention to this epidemic. And it's a fascinating moment within medical history. That is to say, it's the first time we actually see patients really taking on an epidemic on their own and calling for political attention. So to say that the Reagans initiated this move is really a disservice to the gay people of the early 1980s who made HIV a public conversation.
And Hillary Clinton did apologize and say, "I made a mistake," plain and simple.
Right. But I mean, and this is the thing, and it's fine that she apologized, but it goes back to the question, I could say this as a college professor, about, you don't have to take gay history when you're in college. You don't have to know it. People don't teach it. So it's yes, she apologized, and yes, that's fine, and that's great. But the issue is that, like black history and women's history, gay history often remains an elective. So people don't need to know it. They have to know instead, the writing of the Constitution, the bank wars of the 19th century, et cetera. All of these things are fine. But there's a way in which the history of gay people remains not taught in schools today.
So let's talk about the chronicling of gay history. And on a daily basis, you do talk about gay newspapers in here. When did they begin appearing?
Well, there's a long history of gay periodicals and travel guides dating back to the early 20th century, even to the late 19th century. But what happens is, by the early part of the 1970s, there's an explosion of newspapers. And in part, it's a way of connecting gay people across vast places. So in other words, there's the major urban centers. You would have a place like New York or San Francisco or Los Angeles. But what about gay people in the heartland? What about gay people in rural areas? What about gay people who could have been in an urban area but not necessarily connected to the gay community? Newspapers became the conduit, the ways in which gay people were connected, and it created a sense of community.
So The Body Politic, a paper out of Toronto, made a big splash with old news. Why spend so much time on Nazi Germany, people asked?
Right, so this is fascinating. So I obviously love history, but I was reading through The Body Politic, which is this 1970s sort of intellectual newspaper. It's sort of similar to like the New York Review of Books. And all of a sudden, there were all of these stories on Nazism. And so part of it was like, why? And the interesting thing is that many people today, if I said, oh, do you know that gay people were, you know, in the camps during World War II and in Berlin, they would say, yes, they know. But how do they know? They only know that history because in the 1970s, groups of gay male intellectuals traveled to Berlin and started to do the research and write about it, and found out that gay people were in the concentration camps and that they were often exterminated. And so they start publishing these stories in The Body Politic. So part of it's really fascinating to me because it shows a couple of different things. First, it shows that gay people, as a way of creating a sense of culture and identity, need to find a past. They need to find an antecedent. They don't want to just say that they're this timeless creation that just developed yesterday. They have often been engaged in a story of trying to figure out where they came from, who else was gay throughout history. So part of that was, you know, thinking about and learning about how Nazism, what the relationship between Nazism was and homosexuality. Now, here's the very interesting thing that they uncovered. They uncovered that Nazism not only exterminated many homosexuals, but there was a thriving gay world in Berlin in the 1930s. So in the United States, gay liberation begins in the 70s, but they're uncovering that there was this huge gay world in the 1930s. And that was really fascinating to me. And people have written on this and it's become a sort of a similar, a sort of popular topic. But it's also just sort of showing how gay people were looking for an antecedent to their own struggle and the extent to which they feared. Just like Nazism destroyed gay liberation, they were afraid that what would happen to gay liberation in the 1970s in the United States? Could it also be exterminated? Could it also not be told? So that was also part of the reason why they wrote about their history in newspapers, to preserve their past so that it wouldn't be erased.
The Body Politic sounds like it really made an effort to take on some tougher issues of the day. Was that fairly typical of gay newspapers at the time, or were they just all over the map, pretty much like we have newspapers for everybody?
I just sort of feel like this is one of the most interesting things for me, because it's like they're so much more intellectual than people are today. I mean, some of these people, there was a woman named Chris Burchell, and she was a lesbian, and she had a column in The Body Politic, and she was just brilliant. I mean, I don't know if she finished college, but she was, you know, she was had these really sophisticated critiques of patriarchy. She had these really sophisticated critiques of gay liberation, and it's fascinating to me because I think today, as a college professor, I always think of the fact that we are all so professionalized, so that yes, we have ideas, yes, we write books, yes, we think about this, but it all matters in terms of how it's going to play out on your resume or how you're going to get a job. In the 1970s, these people were volunteering their own time. They were sort of engaged in an intellectual project to sort of think about ideas in a way that I don't think gay newspapers are today.
And how influential were they? I mean, it sounds like other institutions were able to use them as means to grow, like the Metropolitan Community Church apparently began by advertising in The Advocate.
Right. So, I mean, this is the main point. I mean, like, they would use these newspapers as a way of connecting people, as a way of advertising events. And so many gay people in the 1970s were looking for a world outside of the bars and the clubs and the bathhouses and so forth. And so, as a result, the newspaper offered other places, other forums for gay people to organize.
Right. So, and what, was the Advocate held in the same intellectual esteem as the Body Politic, for example?
Initially, it was. I mean, in the 1960s, 1970s, it was considered a very reputable paper. And then I think a lot of gay people by the 1970s, the intellectual crowd, sort of like poo-pooed it as being like too glossy, too interested in the social life, too interested in capturing what's called the macho clone, which is this aesthetic of gay men going to the gym and looking a particular way. So I think that's, it kind of went in this different direction. But, you know, what's fascinating is that the papers all have their own intellectual bent, and I talk about that in the chapter and what their focus is and how they differ from each other.
Lots of stuff to talk about with institutions like newspapers that sprang up within the gay community, churches we've already talked about. This is all the subject matter of Jim Downs' book, Stand By Me, The Forgotten History of Gay Liberation. We'll come back and talk more with him and take more phone calls and emails when we return to The Exchange in a minute 15. It's the final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is the historian Jim Downs from Connecticut College. He's written a book about the history of gay people in America, more about the things that got missing in other histories. It's called Stand By Me, The Forgotten History of Gay Liberation, which addresses the 1970s and an apparent jump that happens in a lot of histories of gay rights and gay community in America, which is jumping straight from the Stonewall Uprising of 1969 to the AIDS epidemic of the 1980s. There was a lot of living that went on between those, and that's addressed in this book. You can join us on The Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We have an email here from Wolfgang in Sunny Valley, which he calls Foggy Valley today. He thanks you for your work. He says he's been around gay and lesbian people all his life. And he says, for me, your information is interesting, but it doesn't change or really need me to change perceptions. What I would like to know is how your book can or should affect the average person out there who's usually just getting by, avoiding controversial issues, and never examines their own feelings and reactions. That, again, from Wolfgang in Sunny Valley.
Well, I mean, I think that's great. Wolfgang has, if he already has a sort of positive interpretation of gay people. But I would say that the book is also in many ways explaining in great detail the creation of community and culture in the 1970s. And I think that thinking about, as we talked about, the sort of creation of churches, the creation of a print culture, of newspapers, the creation of a concern of within the newspapers for prisoners' rights. I mean, one of the things I discovered that was like so fascinating was that today we talk a lot about mass incarceration. It's become the topic du jour. But in the 1970s, gay people on the progressive left were already engaged in a conversation about reforming prisoners' rights and making life in prison better for gay people. And one of the things that happened in the 1970s is that there's a keen awareness that, yes, many gay people outside of prisons have engaged and enjoyed some moment of some feeling of liberation, but many have been left in prison and have not been part of this world. And there was an article that I found in a newspaper called Joined Hands called The Forgotten Ones. And it was all about the irony that despite all of this sort of gains that were made during the 1970s for gay people, that so many of them remained incarcerated.
Let's see, we have an email here from, a phone call from Beth in Roseburg. Welcome to The Exchange with Jim Downs.
Hi, thank you very much. I wonder if he can address the history of lesbians in the battered women's movement in America.
Okay, thanks for that, Beth.
Right. So, I mean, there's a really interesting and fascinating history about the ways in which many lesbians have sort of worked in social reform efforts from domestic violence to other social justice causes. My book was in many ways invested in thinking about how we have inherited a hypersexual narrative about gay men to explain HIV. And thereby, what I wanted to do was to say, what were gay men doing during this period? What was their life? What were their concerns? What were their interests? And so at times, I mean, to sort of think about lesbians would also have to actually write a completely different book. And so they do appear in the book, but I'm also trying to sort of like counter this narrative about gay men.
Well, the narrative does tend to focus on a figure. It's almost like a Marlboro man of gayness, in a sense, the macho clone, you call it. Describe
right.
what that symbol was.
So what happens is in the late 1970s, there's this development of this sort of clone. And basically what he looks like is he wears jeans, probably no shirt, a black vest, aviator sunglasses. And he sort of embodies a kind of masculinity that was often considered to be the province of straight men. And what's so fascinating is that in the early 1970s, gay people were rebelling against this idea that the medical community has called them aberrant or third sex or feminine. And once they realized that being gay did not indict their masculinity, once they started to sort of realize that being gay was not some kind of medical aberration, they started to embrace a more sort of masculine kind of aesthetic.
And so you do write that, getting back to the earlier question here, about the macho clone diminishing the presence of lesbians in the history of the 1970s.
Right. And so what happens is that the macho clone sort of emerges by the end of the decade, and what it does is it sort of becomes the symbol of the gay movement, and it completely erases people of color from the early part of the movement. And when Stonewall breaks out in 1969, that's a sort of multicultural, diverse group of people that are engaged in the political uprising. There's transgender people, there are people of color, there are women. Yet as the decade sort of continues, those groups of people get pushed to the margins. And as a result, the sort of macho clone, both symbolically and literally, begins to sort of define the gay movement.
All right. So we also talk about ways in which, the more I think about this as we go through, talking about things like gay churches and gay newspapers, I mean, it sounds like another realm of the separate but not necessarily equal institutions of society that had to arise for African Americans or other portions of the
right.
community that were downtrodden. So let me get to a larger question first, which is, how have the institutions fared? Have they stayed around, or gay people have come into the mainstream, has this become less of an issue? Are they not around as much now?
Right. I mean, some of these institutions, the churches are still around, but the print culture has basically died out. And it was interesting because in the 1990s, when I came out and I started meeting gay people and was part of the gay community, I could walk into a friend's apartment and he would have copies of The Advocate or Out Magazine or some gay periodical. This was in the 90s. Today, that doesn't exist. I mean, I think these magazines are still out there, but there's far fewer, and most gay men don't subscribe to them. So I feel like part of it was the idea that they feel as if they no longer need it, that they have sort of arrived politically and there's no longer a need for gay people to have something of their own.
Well, some of those things like something of their own. Craig Rodwell had a vision of a bookstore for gay people. Talk about his motivations and his what he did with them.
Right. So Craig Rodwell is like a fascinating character because he was so adamant about wanting to create a space outside of the bars and the bathhouses. And so he wanted to create a bookstore. He wanted to emphasize the fact that gay people have a long literary tradition dating from Oscar Wilde and Langston Hughes to others. He wanted to be able to have a place where people can meet during the day and then not just have to congregate at night. And so what he did was he created the first ever gay bookstore in New York City. And it was around for 20 or 30 years, and it recently closed. And I think his bookstore is very similar to other bookstores that sort of developed throughout the country and other parts of the world, especially in England. You saw the creation of these sort of gay-themed bookstores. And they're very similar to feminist bookstores that developed also during this period. So But this world, and it's not just because of Amazon, but this world has sort of declined. Again, there's no longer this sort of feeling among a lot of gay people to have these kind of cultural centers. I mean, a lot of, I think, gay people, it's changing. And I'm more of a historian, so I don't want to, like, get too much or create too much of a commentary on the present. But I think a lot of gay people, or many, don't want to sort of assimilate more and not see themselves as different. And I think in the 1970s, there was a pride in gay people seeing themselves as different from straight people.
What were the reactions once the Oscar Wilde Memorial Bookshop opened up? I mean, you had some real positive stuff, but some real negative things too, it sounds like.
Right. Well, one of the things that happened, I mean, is, well, first the positive stuff, was that people like Tennessee Williams would come to this store, and like very Christopher Isherwood. I mean, like, really famous writers would do readings at the Oscar Wilde bookstore, which is just really fascinating. But then the other part was that it goes back to this, you know, concern I have throughout the book about violence, that because these people, because the bookstore was open and it was exposed and people could see it, it was often the target of violence. And people vandalized it, people threw rocks through the window, people harassed, you know, the employees. I mean, it was, and it's really sad to sort of think about the kinds of violence and problems that developed.
A writer named Jonathan Ned Katz was inspired by the Oscar Wilde Memorial Bookshop. What did he write?
So Jonathan Ned Katz was part of this intellectual group in New York on the Upper West Side, and he was really interested in history, and he was involved and engaged in reading about Nazism and so forth. And he went to the Oscar Wilde bookstore to pick up a pamphlet about Nazism in Berlin. And when he walked in, it was, you know, sort of life-changing moment that he sort of began to sort of realize that he wanted to write books. And what he wrote was the first ever sort of primary source collection called Gay American History. And Gay American History is an anthology, which basically means that it's a combination of sources from the 18th century to the mid-20th that shows evidence of gay people throughout history. Court cases, newspaper articles, diary entries. And so part of this was proving that gay people had a long history.
How hard was it, I wonder, for him to research that? I mean, here again, since you know, gay people generally didn't write history books for long periods of time, or at least didn't write them as out people. How much difficulty would have had uncovering some of the details of things that happened in previous generations?
What's really fascinating about him, and I think about a lot of gay people in the early 1970s, was that they're very much influenced by Black Civil Rights Movement, and they're influenced by Black Power Movement, and they're influenced by the Women's Movement. And so he actually got his start writing about Black people in the 19th century. He wanted to know more about resistance. He wanted to know more about slavery. He wanted to understand. He wanted a sort of context for the civil rights movement. And so that training in Black history allowed him to then understand how the archive works. And, like, in other words, how do you find research when people didn't leave records? How could you read against a court case to find information about gay people? How could you find evidence about people who have otherwise been marginalized and neglected? And so that sort of training in Black history taught him, you know, to think about questions about power and to sort of think about how sources developed in the first place, which is, sounds very technical, but really what he was trying to do was, like, work. He knew that he couldn't just show up at the Library of Congress or the National Archives and find stuff about gay people. He knew he had to sort of read against the grain in order to get the experiences of gay people. In other words, they might not be using the name gay, they might not be using the word homosexual, but, like, how could you find clues that suggested same-sex intimacy?
Let's talk about the political activism of the times and whether there was much. I mean, we can certainly compare and contrast with today when, you know, Supreme Court decision last year legalizing same-sex marriage across the country. But was it very much an underground sort of thing back then, or was it more upfront, depending on where you were, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I found really interesting is that, like, a lot of gay people were obviously invested and engaged in this question of changing laws and making and of addressing the political system and of you're gaining some kind of recognition and equality. But many of them, actually have a critique of democracy. They have a critique of capitalism. So they actually don't want to be part of this world. Like, they're not looking to gain recognition for to be part of the state. I mean, they're actually turning their backs to it. And so this is also true of lesbians. I mean, lesbians, have began what's called a separatist movement, which is that they would move out and create their own sort of communities, their own world. They weren't interested in trying to get people in City Hall or in the federal government to recognize or validate their love or validate their existence. They were more interested in creating a community for themselves. And I think that's the point. I mean, to answer, Wolfgang's question from before, I mean, that's one of the points that we have to sort of think about, is that we can't think that gay people throughout time were always just interested and engaged in this question of gaining political recognition. They turned the other way, and they were more interested in creating a world for themselves.
Well, we learn a whole lot in this book, and we do, in fact, get the whole idea of the gay community in the 1970s and 80s moved away from the bars and bathhouses into much more, well, perhaps mundane institutions. The book is called Stand By Me, The Forgotten History of Gay Liberation. Jim Downs wrote it and joined us today in the exchange. Jim, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, take care.